Hello and welcome to True Crime Talker San Diego, your local true crime podcast. I'm your host Jamie and this is episode number 16. Today we're going to be talking about a cold case that was only recently solved after 25 years. It's just so wild to think that someone can do something so heinous as murder and then get away with it for decades. But before I go into today's case, let's jump into this week's news story topic. COVID has been hard on everyone, and it hit the entertainment industry pretty bad as well. Thankfully, things are turning around and artists are able to go back out and start performing for people, all of that jazz. A San Diego musician was excited to get back out there and play his first show in over 13 months. That musician's father was on his way to attend that very show in the Gaslamp Quarter District. However, he would not make it to the venue. Last Thursday night, gunfire erupted around 10:30 p.m. in the busy downtown nightlife district. Travis Sereste casually walked down 5th Avenue and J Street. Unprovoked, Travis pulled out a handgun and shot the valet working outside of the Pendry Hotel. As the gunman began to walk away, he quickly turned around and fired again at the valet. The victim was 28-year-old Justice Bolden, who sadly died on the scene after being shot in the upper body. Travis Sereste then casually walked on down the street as if nothing had happened. About a block later, Travis confronted a group of men and then opened fire on them as well. Then again, he casually walked past his victims down the street. Thankfully, two Samaritans heard the gunfire and jumped into action. Both Justin Larrabee and Matthew McKeon followed the shooter and tackled Travis to the ground, where he was held until police could rush onto the scene and subdue the man with a taser. McKeon said, quote, "It was the right thing to do. He had just shot people right in front of me, and at this point, I'm thinking, if I don't follow him, there's no police following him. There's no one who will be able to tell who he is at the gas lamp on Thursday night, where he could just be another face in the street." The group of men who were in the second shooting attack were hospitalized, and all are thankfully expected to recover. What's interesting about the story is not only was this just a out-of-the-blue violence, but the shooter used a 9mm ghost gun, which is an unregistered or unserialized firearm. Makes you wonder if this was truly a planned killing spree, or if it was just a spur-of-the-moment fit of violence. Travis Sereste was arrested on Thursday night after the shooting and was taken to a hospital for injuries. He is not cooperating with police investigation and has invoked his Fifth Amendment right. He is now facing charges that include 1 count of murder and 5 counts of attempted murder, and is scheduled to appear in court on May 3rd. Today, we're talking about the Mary Scott case. Mary Scott was the oldest of 6 siblings. Her family describes her as being very sweet and big-hearted, but also kind of naive for the world that she was living in. At just 17 years old, Mary dropped out of high school and married a Navy sailor. Together, the couple moved to Louisiana, where they had 2 children. After a few years of marriage, Mary eventually separated from her husband and moved back out to California. At first, she had her kids with her in San Diego, but providing for and raising your family is tough as a single mother. So, the children go back to Louisiana to be with their father and his family. The year is now 1969, and Mary Scott is a young woman in her early 20s living alone in San Diego. She was able to get a job as a cocktail waitress at a club called Star and Garter. This was great because the club is only 3 blocks from her apartment on 39th Street, so commuting to and from work was cheap and convenient for her. Eventually, Mary moved up and started working as a go-go dancer there, and was known by patrons as her nickname, Lucky. Now you know something bad is going to happen whenever I start to mention a date. On November 20th, 1969, Lucky wasn't so lucky, because she didn't end up showing up to work that day. This was very unusual for Mary. She wasn't the type of person to just not show up to a shift without at least a call. By 8 p.m. that evening, a concerned coworker, Dolores Christofferson, stopped by her place to see if Mary was okay. Now, Mary lived on the bottom level of an apartment complex, and as her coworker walked up to her home, she could immediately tell something terrible had happened to Mary. The door to her apartment was completely broken, and it was very evident that someone had forcefully broken in. Furniture was flipped over, and the place was in disarray. As Dolores continued further in, she discovers Mary's lifeless body laying face up on the floor of her apartment. Gosh, what a tragic scene to just stumble upon. I can't imagine how traumatic that must have been for her. Ugh. So Dolores calls the police, and investigators get to work surveying the crime scene. They theorize that Mary must have been getting ready for bed when she heard a knock on the door. She had already locked up for the night, so she opens the door just a crack, leaving the security chain in place. Her visitor came with malicious intent and took that opportunity to break in and attack Miss Scott. Her offender hit the door so hard that it completely broke off the security chain and the door molding. The door swung open and hit Mary in the face so forcefully that it broke her jaw. Based upon the state of the room and a broken chair, it is very evident that a brutal struggle then ensued. Mary was tragically beaten, raped, and strangled to death that night. And as for her killer, well, he left her on the floor with her flower nightgown disheveled around her legs. Authorities collected evidence and began their investigation. Numerous people were interviewed, including the cab driver who had drove Mary Scott home. This murder must have really stuck with that driver because Thomas Giaquinto later goes on to join the San Diego Police Department. He rose through the ranks and became a homicide detective himself, which I have to say is pretty cool. The investigation continues, and there was even a rumor that Mary Scott was the victim of a Las Vegas mob hit. Suspects and other sexual assaults in the area were questioned, but that theory never really panned out to anything concrete. So, with no suspect and little leads, Mary Scott's case sadly goes cold. Rosalie Sands is Mary's youngest sister and ends up playing a huge role in her sister's case. At the time, Rosalie was just a teenager in 1969. She still remembers that day that she was told her sister was murdered. She looked out the window of her family's home on a dark November night. Two men in suits approached her home, and her mother answered the door. She remembers her mother listening quietly to the detectives as they explained that her 23-year-old daughter, Mary Scott, had been murdered. "It was very brief," Rosalie says. "They closed the door, and my mom came to tell me that my sister had been killed." With the case turning cold, life just went on and on for the next 50 years. But Rosalie would never forget her sister. I mean, how could you? Just a few years ago, Rosalie began seeing how new DNA technology was helping investigators find suspects in other murders and cold cases, especially after the news of the Golden State Killer. Now, this got Rosalie thinking, why can't they do that with Mary's case? 2019 was the 50th anniversary of the murder, and Rosalie decided to reach out to a friend who was a retired police officer. This friend helped contact people still on the police force, and the Mary Scott case was reopened. Investigators from the San Diego Police Cold Case Unit and the San Diego District Attorney's Office Cold Case Unit evaluated the case and were able to use forensic genealogy to identify a possible suspect. Finally, a potential suspect could be investigated. This was huge news for Rosalie. There was finally potential for justice. Detectives, assisted by the FBI, compared the DNA collected from the crime scene against genealogy databases. Forensic genealogy is a new tool investigators are using to solve cases nowadays. I've talked more extensively about this process in past cases, so if you want to learn more about other San Diego cases that are solved using this technology, then I recommend checking out episode 9 and 5 to hear the tragic stories of Jodine Sarin and Barbara Becker. But basically, what genealogists are doing in these types of cold cases is they're trying to match crime scene DNA to relatives of the unknown perpetrator by using publicly accessible DNA databases. Once they get a hit, this helps them create family trees in hopes of putting a name to the mystery DNA found at a crime scene, therefore locating the suspect of the DNA. Oftentimes, in cases as old as Mary Scott's, the families learn about the perpetrators too late, and they've missed out on justice because the perpetrator may have already died. But thankfully for Rosalie, this break in the case came just in time. Authorities linked John Sipos to the cold case as a probable suspect. Now, military records show that John Sipos was stationed at Naval Air Station Miramar in 1969, and one of his addresses was just 2 miles from Mary's apartment. Military men also often frequented the Star and Garter Club, which could explain how John met and interacted with Mary. July 22nd of last year was Trash Day on Cobbler Road in Shecksville, Pennsylvania, home of John Sipos. FBI agents went through John's trash and found a bandage with some blood on it. I know the SDPD is not allowed to snoop through people's trash without a warrant, but the rules may have been different in Pennsylvania, and maybe even so for the FBI. But anyways, they end up finding this bandage, and then they send the DNA from the blood on that bandage to the lab. By September, lab test results showed that the DNA on that bandage, in fact, matched the DNA evidence found on Mary's body. So, knowing that John was in the immediate area at the time of the crime, plus linking his DNA to the crime scene, this gave police the green light to charge Mr. Sipos for the murder of Mary Scott. Authorities arrest 75-year-old John Sipos near his Pennsylvania house on October 24, 2020. He's being held in Lehigh County Detention Center, awaiting extradition to San Diego. Unlike Pennsylvania, California allows bail for homicide suspects, and John's bail was set at $3 million. Deputy District Attorney Chris Lindbergh said that he asked for a significant bail based on Sipos' ties to Pennsylvania, the length of time he was able to evade arrest, and the brutal nature of the killing. John's attorney, Brooke LaFrance, said that she argued for significantly lower bail, noting that her client is considered innocent until proven guilty. She argues that Sipos had absolutely no criminal record and retired 20 years ago after spending 30 years working in hospital administration and security. And since then, he has lived on a modest retirement with his wife. The attorney also pointed to the spread of COVID-19 in the jails, and she's concerned that John could succumb to the virus should he catch it, given his heart problems and diabetes. John appeared at his arraignment via video and was not charged with rape because the statute of limitations for that crime has sadly expired. But thankfully, there is no time limit for a suspect to be arrested for murder. John Sipos was represented by a public defender at the arraignment hearing, but his Allentown attorney, John Waldron, has been retained by John's family and remains involved in this case. Waldron says that the Sipos family is devastated over John's arrest. They were really hoping that he would be let out on bail, and they're super worried about him being in there with COVID going on, especially with his health conditions. But unfortunately for John, that doesn't seem very likely. Now, as for John himself, he pleads not guilty. He denied any involvement in the murder and denied knowing the victim. He said he would never associate with someone like that, aka a go-go dancer. Which personally, I think is a really weird statement to say, that he wouldn't even associate with someone like her. I mean, he was a young man at that time in the Navy, there's nothing wrong associating with a go-go dancer. It's not like she was a prostitute or something. I don't know. I just found that that remark really rubbed me the wrong way. I mean, he's clearly trying to diminish Mary's death and humanity by trying to associate her with a prostitute. But even if Mary had been a prostitute, that still doesn't mean that she deserved to be murdered in such a way. So, the fact that a man who allegedly broke in, raped, and murdered someone has the audacity to diminish Mary's character and lifestyle, it just frustrates me and blows my mind. Like, sorry buddy, but you don't have the moral high ground when facing murder charges here. But anyways, John maintains his innocence and plans to fight the charges, saying that the science the allegations are based on is unreliable. Which, again, seems a bit cocky when the science used in this case has solved many other cases, including one as huge as the Golden State Killer. So, with all that, I think the science has proven very effective. So, good luck proving the science wrong, because I think you're gonna have a hard time with that. Now, if convicted, John faces a sentence of 7 years to life, because that was the sentence for first-degree murder in California at the time of Mary's death. Today, it's currently 25 years to life. So, we shall see what comes of this trial and if he will be found guilty or not. Sadly, today, Rosalie Sands is the last member of Mary Scott's immediate family, and one of the few to be able to speak about the life of her sister. Their parents have since died, as have the other siblings, 3 brothers and a sister. Rosalie says, quote, "It's just me that remembers her. It is nice to be able to speak for her after all this time. The big headline was go-go girl found dead, but there's more to Mary than just being a go-go dancer." Now, as I've said before, Rosalie played a huge role in her sister's case, and is basically the one who rejuvenated it and got the case potentially solved. Now that we have a possible suspect, Rosalie reflects on the 50 years of life that John had had and that her sister had lost. Quote, "He went on to live his life, and that is the thing that makes me the most upset. When I learn that he's just living free and happy, it is upsetting to me that he had that normal life all these years. She had so much life ahead of her that just got stolen." I couldn't agree more. It must have been so frustrating seeing her sister's case go cold for literally decades, not knowing if justice would ever be served. My hat really does go off to Rosalie for not giving up and keeping Mary's memory alive. Well, that's all I've got for this week's episode. I hope you all enjoyed this one. If so, don't forget to hop on over to iTunes to leave a rating and review. That would really help out the show, and I appreciate all the love and support from you guys. All the links are provided below, and also feel free to get in touch with your thoughts and theories on any of the cases from the show. I also take case suggestions as well, so if you have any, hit me up. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay safe.